Hello, welcome to the Somewhere For Us podcast. My guest today is an award-winning author and performance poet. His memoir, published and out now, is a bold and intimate meditation on bodies, age and self-acceptance. Both candid and courageous, Person Unlimited explores their life across the many roles they've played, from choir boy to drag act, grandson to mentor, poet to lover. It looks at what he's carried in his body, wins and losses, shame and pride, pain and joy, and investigates how radical self-acceptance and a willingness to abide with discomfort open up the possibility of a life lived beyond definition, a Person Unlimited. He joins me for a remote but super friendly conversation. He is Dean Atta. Dean, I'm catching you at the very beginning of your promotional trail for your amazing new book, Person Unlimited, an ode to my black queer body.
That's right, Jules. You're the first person I'm talking to about this book outside of my family and my publisher, Canongate. So it's been, yeah, this is the beginning. So thank you for being the first.
And I feel a lot of pressure, if I'm honest.
Don't feel pressure.
I'm really pleased that I could get in first.
Well, my partner and I had a really fun practice driving down from Scotland. So we live in London now, but we were up in Scotland last week for a wedding in Perth and then visiting friends in Glasgow and a couple of days in Skye. And we had a lovely time. But on the drive down from Glasgow to London, my partner was doing some practice interview questions with me. So he's officially my first interviewer, but we didn't record that, thankfully. But it's a long drive.
I've got an idea about what I want to ask you, but now I'm feeling like I want to know what they were asking.
No comment.
I think where I wanted to start was, this is a really personal book. And there were complicated feelings coming up for me with the book in terms of my own journey, and so much that it's really vivid, and there's such rich language in it, and you've got lots of short sentences in there, which I find actually really helped me understand some really big topics as you were going through it. So the writing style I found was really helpful for me. I think the thing I want to ask is, it's a really personal book. I know you've done personal work before.
Yep.
And that's been a really big part of your work. But how do you feel going out, promoting it and talking about it, given how personal it is?
Well, shall I tell the listeners what it's about so they kind of get a sense of what this personal stuff is? So the book,
Person
Unlimited, An Ode to My Black Queer Body. So the book focuses on the body, seven parts of the body, starting at the crown, moving through to the root. So kind of inspired by my yoga practice, my meditation. And these are the kind of things that have helped me with some of the difficult challenges that I've kind of faced in my life, you know, as a black queer person facing racism, homophobia, but also having experienced sexual assault. I use this book to talk about those complex experiences and the emotions attached to them, but kind of ground it within the body or embody these experiences. So it doesn't stay in one place and time. It moves backwards and forwards. So you get my childhood, you get my time living in Glasgow with my partner, but you get me growing up in London as well, as kind of our camper van trips we took in the Outer Hebrides more recently. And so it's kind of, it moves through space and time. And so because of that, because it kind of goes backwards and forwards, it has flashbacks and it jumps forward. And, you know, I wanted to ground it and locate it in the body. So we always come back to the body. And so that was the way I chose to kind of shape this book, because otherwise my stories and anecdotes and life has gone everywhere. So I think, yeah, really locating it in the body is something I do anyway, just to bring myself back to the present moment and to how I'm feeling in any given moment, you know, not dwelling too much on the past and not kind of worrying too much about the future, which I think lots of people can do, you know? And so so I use the stories in the book to show the past and think about the future, but always keep it grounded in the present moment of where my body is when I'm kind of telling the story to the reader. And I try and make it personal in a sense of, like, I'm talking to you like you're my friend, someone I know and trust, because I have to feel like I can trust you to open up about some of the topics I'm talking about.
Yeah, I felt that, and I definitely felt the embodiment of it. Like, I felt really present in my body during it, and I was sort of thinking about my, you know, I don't mean, yeah, it's a strange thing to be talking about me when I'm thinking about reading your words, but
I did feel really connected to it.
Yeah, I felt really connected to it, and I think that's also why I find it hard to, in parts, you know, because your own experiences and your own experiences with your body and things that have happened to you, you know, really present when you're recounting your story too.
Yeah.
So I didn't find that too difficult, if you know what I mean. But I did find it a journey for myself.
Yeah.
So I found myself kind of at one point I had my hand on my chest, you know, and over my heart at one point, as I was reading, I was just really conscious of it, where my body was at and how I was holding myself and what I was thinking about.
Yeah. And obviously the heart is one of the sections of the book. And I think, you know, that I surprised myself what I chose to start with, you know, my grandfather's heart attack and him, you know, dying, and kind of thinking about grief and depression and the similarities in the body that I was feeling when I was grieving my grandfather reminded me of my depression, which was more serious for me when I was younger. And so like that embodied experience, kind of how both grief and depression showed up in my body and the kind of like, you know, the parallels across time that I was feeling in those kind of weeks and months that followed his death. But then the heart, you know, opening up to kind of appreciate those that are alive, but also appreciate what those who have passed have contributed to my life, you know. So I found, you know, you start with a body part, but it can take you in quite an expansive, you know, all directions.
Yeah. I love how you sort of, there's an acceptance of the different forms of love in the book, especially when you're talking about family members and your relationship with them, and how you, there's almost an acceptance of the limitations of, not limitations is the wrong word, but there's an acceptance of the type of love that people are able to give you.
Yes.
Absolutely. And that you're able to receive.
Absolutely.
And I think there is, rather than trying to unpick that and change it and feel uncomfortable with it for the, you know, there is, I feel like through the book, you've, there's a, an acceptance that comes with it by the end.
Yes, definitely. And kind of knowing, you know, different generations and different kind of life experiences mean people approach things, you know, wildly differently. And, you know, my grandfather, when my mum first had me, was very unhappy that both my mum wasn't married, but also that she'd had a baby with a black man. And so, you know, my family, a mixed family, my mum's from Cyprus, my dad's from Jamaica, but they were both born and raised in London, as was I. But my grandparents came from Cyprus and Jamaica, and they came with their own kind of ideas about what they wanted for their children and their children's future. And I think, you know, an unmarried single mother wasn't what my granddad wanted for my mum. And yet by the time I was kind of old enough to know him, you know, they'd gotten over that and they were back in each other's lives. And so I knew my grandfather as a very loving, kind of calm, kind man. I sometimes saw him shout and be grumpy, but many, many people can do that. And yet, you know, I knew from my mum the stories of when, you know, she first had me and how he basically disowned her, and it did contribute to my wondering whether he would accept me being gay. Once I knew I was gay, would I tell him? And I decided not to. He actually died without ever knowing I was gay, and that was something that, a decision I made and don't regret, but have reflected upon in the book, and kind of the conclusion I've kind of come to is I didn't have a partner whom I wanted to introduce to my grandfather and risk that relationship for the other. Do you know what I mean? So I have had many lovely boyfriends, but until my current partner, I've not had someone that I'd be willing to like lose family over. And I guess that means he also now feels like family to me. And that's a different kind of love, where your partner becomes your family. That hadn't happened prior with any boyfriends I'd had. So yeah, family comes in many shapes and forms. And obviously the next generation of my family features in the book as well, my nieces. And I think they bring some levity to the book.
Oh, I loved when you're talking about, yeah, your relationship with your nieces and how that you hadn't really considered your uncles, you know, until you became an uncle yourself.
Yeah, when you become an uncle, you realize like how much My own uncles were showing up for me, you know, in place of my dad not actually being around for me very much. My uncles on both sides, my Cypriot and Jamaican uncles, were really there and constant and still are. And so I had a lot to be grateful for. But then I also realized, you know, what an important role I could play for my nieces and, you know, with my partner as well. You know, we kind of try and take them out in the camper van, get them out of London, you know, to see the countryside, to go to the seaside, you know, to walk in forests, to see sheep and cows, to, you know, these are the things I didn't really do much of when I was a kid. So it's nice that this kind of things can be part of my niece's life now, and me and my partner can be, you know, these role models and fun figures in their lives, as my uncles are for me.
Issue 15 of the Somewhere Frost magazine is out now. Izzy Med has created another standout cover for the issue called We Are Family. And if you're not already part of the Somewhere family, for exclusive gifts and your very own copies of our quarterly magazine, visit somewherefrost.org and sign up today. We want to keep supporting queer artists' enterprise, exploring our culture and celebrating our heritage. And your support helps us to tell those stories and make sure they're never forgotten. Discover more at somewherefrost.org.
And it's so interesting how we reflect and look forward all at the same time sometimes. Yeah. Just by the role we're having to play in people's lives, you know.
Exactly.
Can I take you back to take you back to the writing style of the book?
Absolutely.
I felt like there was a really childlike voice coming through from the beginning, and I wondered whether that
I know why.
I wonder whether you agree with that, and also did this emerge like unknowingly, or did you have a sense that it would be present all the way through?
I knew it would be present all the way through because I'd made a decision to refer to my mum as mummy consistently throughout the book. Mm-hmm. So I think that already gives a childlike tone. You know, even on, you know, my Jamaican side of the family, my uncles and aunts and dad, I think all call my Jamaican grandma mummy as well. And so I think I'd heard it that way with that family, and it just stuck with me. Like when I talk about my mum, I call her my mum. But when I talk to her, I call her mummy. If I ever call her actual name, she would be so confused. And so, yeah, it's just kind of how it is. Like, and so I knew that would be something that would stand out to people. I like it. And also, I think because the book consistently reflects on my childhood self, he's always with me, my younger self, and that repairing that relationship with my younger self, because I feel there are times when he couldn't be protected by his mummy, you know, like when he was left in the barbershop. You know, the first part of the book is the hair section. And, you know, one of my formative experiences with my hair was being taken to the barbershop. And eventually my mum would just drop me off there and I'd get my hair cut, or I'd walk back to my grandparents' house, which was nearby. And so when she wasn't there and no women were there, you heard all sorts of kind of sexist and sometimes homophobic remarks being made about women, and derogatory remarks being made about gay men, and the Jamaican dancehall music being played on the speakers that had a lot of homophobia and quite sexually aggressive lyrics towards women as well.
It's such a formative time in your life.
Yeah, and I would have been up for you, you know? 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, so it was young, and I was there with my Game Boy, you know, pretending I wasn't listening, just kind of playing Tetris or something on the Game Boy, and just kind of attempting to zone out. But you hear it and you feel it, and you know you are. I knew I was gay from quite young, and they use this Jamaican kind of term, patois term, batty man, which just means, you know, gay man in a kind of derogatory way, to talk about people that weren't only gay, you know, sometimes just people that were effeminate or they considered to be weak or not masculine enough. And so those remarks, I was like, that's me, I'm that thing, even when I didn't fully comprehend it. And that really got to me, and people were never directly rude or nasty to me, but I absorbed it, you know, and I took that on. And so
Well, they're telling you how they feel about the world. So it's exactly. when you work out where you are exactly. in the world, it's like...
And to be clear, I'm talking about the 80s and early 90s. And, you know, that same barbershop in Northwest London I've been to, you know, not so long ago or, you know, a couple
really?
Of years ago. And, you know, the barber I went to was like, oh, have you seen anything good in the theatre? Me and my wife went to see this musical. And so it's completely different now. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like it's...
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know, actually.
I actually prefer barbers where no one talks.
Yeah, me too. I totally agree with that. No, what was coming to mind, we go down to visit my wife's mum mm-hmm. down in Suffolk, mm-hmm. deepest, darkest Suffolk. And I've done it more than once, mm-hmm. which I was sort of questioning in my mind why I'm doing it, but I've taken my five-year-old
yeah.
to go and get a trim,
yeah.
Who's always had quite long hair.
Yeah.
And he's... yeah, it's getting in his eyes and stuff. So we've been kind of trimming it, not trying not to take away the feeling of having longer hair,
okay.
but trying to make it a little bit more manageable.
Yeah.
And so I went into this barber's and it was just full of men with the same haircut, which was a really, really sort of buzz, you know, almost like the one you described having the Nike tick,
yeah.
you know, at the back.
Yeah.
I could really picture these guys that are in this barber's that we go to. And they sat him down and the first thing that they said to me when they sat him down, they went, you want it all off? And they got the shavers out. And I went, panic. I was like, I said, well, it's got to be his decision, mm. you know, what he wants with his hair. So well, let's ask him. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he said, I don't want it off. And no. I was like, well, I know. So I said, you tell him what you'd like. So he said, just a little bit. And he held out his fingers and it was about an inch, mm, you know, mm. he's like, I want that much off. Mm-hmm. And the guy said, yeah, but he's like, don't you want to look like a footballer
wow.
or something? And I was like, oh, and I said something like, but a lot of footballers have long hair. So I'm not really sure, you know. And then he went, oh, you want a messy haircut? And I was like, ooh. Messy haircut. I'm getting entangled into something here that I'm like, I just listen to him and he'll tell you because he was able to, you know. But it was really like, oh, clearly you've come here to sort this kid out. Yeah, okay. And I was like, oh my goodness. And I felt really, I suddenly got that panic of like, oh, I have to defend him, but also I want him to speak for himself. And, mm-hmm. And also that I was really conscious of what he was hearing in the shop.
Yeah.
With the other, because there were other boys sat there
yeah.
and what they were talking about. And I didn't feel comfortable, I have to say. So that there was a completely different situation, but mm. I feel like those spaces can be really potent.
Yes. Yes. And I think, yeah, yeah. I think you did a good job advocating for your son there.
Oh, I don't know.
I think so. And there's obviously, you can have conversations after. You can't figure everything out in the moment. You know, and
yeah, that's good to remember. That is good to remember.
Something for me and my mum with this book is, you know, I wrote a full first draft and then I showed it to her and then we discussed what she remembered differently and what she could add to it as well. You know, she said, oh, well, actually, there's some things that you maybe didn't understand why that was happening. And let me tell you. And so it allowed for a really great conversation.
Oh, that's nice.
And the same could
I
be
think
true.
Everyone needs to write a book. If everybody writes a book and then hands it to their parents, then yeah. yeah.
But
it sounds like you do have a really, you have a good relationship with your mum to be able to have that conversation. I mean, she's got this kind of raw persistence in the book, in this pursuit of fitting in or getting it right for you.
Yeah.
And for your sister as well. And there's that, like, I think you do a good job of kind of describing what the experience was like for her.
Yes. I think our parents
feel like there
want
is a voice for her
us.
In the book.
Yeah, our parents want the best for us. And I think some parents are aware of their limitations and will try and bring in other people to help and support the situation too. And I think my mum wasn't afraid of, like, you know, enlisting grandparents' help to look after me, uncles' help to, you know, be role models where my dad wasn't there. But also, you know, realizing she may have been restricted in kind of what was perceived as a good life and success. And so she wanted me and my sister to be happy. And, you know, the only advice she really ever gave us was like, do what makes you happy, which is actually really tough yeah. because you have to be like, what will make me happy? You know,
so what makes me happy? And when you're not happy,
yeah.
like, I'm getting it wrong. I'm
and
getting
when
it
you're
wrong.
A kind of like depressed teenager, like who doesn't know whether he wants to go to drama school or uni or or stay in bed and cry, like, you know, you don't really know what you want to do. But she's like, whatever makes you happy. I'm like, well, therapy, I guess, like was the answer to that question.
yeah, to unpick it all.
Yeah.
Just on that note around depression, I thought your description of depression quite early on in the book was just exquisite, actually. It begins, I was underwater in our baby blue bathtub.
Yes.
And then it goes on in a paragraph to describe how depression felt for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that kind of underwater feeling, everything muffled. You can't really, you see the surface, but you can't swim up to it or reach it. You know, I felt minuscule, like it was like the bathtub grew to this humongous size. It was like being at the bottom of the ocean. And I think the ocean kind of comes back in the book several times, and, you know, wild swimming, but also kind of just trusting yourself in an expanse of water, you know. And I say trusting yourself rather than the water, because, you know, the water is ambivalent to you. So, I think depression was something that, you know, until I've kind of come through many bouts of it, like it was very hard to understand it and think about a good metaphor for it, you know, but that was the one that fit my teenage depression especially. And I think the baby blue bathtub, I think because it's got the word baby in it, but also blue, this idea of being a boy and kind of the color
blue
and what that means and trying to fit in, but knowing you don't, and kind of drowning in expectations, even though they're not coming from, say, my mum. There were a lot of societal expectations and pressures on a boy, and there was a lot of kind of a wave of emotions, I want to call it, but, you know, both negative and positive. Like, I was excited about the prospect of, you know, finding a boyfriend and maybe a husband one day. But I knew that, like, as someone brought up in the Church of England, like, being gay was a sin, and, you know, there wasn't equal marriage at the time. And there had been Section 28 for the whole time of me being in school, both primary and secondary school, because Section 28 was 1988 to 2003 in England, at least.
Yeah, it was present for my entire schooling.
Same for me. Yeah. And obviously we had, you know, the HIV AIDS epidemic. And the first thing my mum had said to me, sadly, after I came out was like, you've got to be careful, you know, you don't want to get HIV. And so that stuck.
Amazing that is. I honestly think that's what my mum would have said to me if I was coming out as a gay man. I feel like that's exactly what she would have said to me.
Yeah,
because I think it says so much about that era of the big gravestone on the television and the, do you know, the just and Thatcher and just,
yeah,
you know, where the consciousness was around what it meant to be homosexual at that time.
Yeah.
It was just so synonymous with being ill.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, and the fear then, I think, for parents and how that then sort of embedded in the way they treated, you know, children who came out.
Yes.
It for some might have been more kind of caring and worried about it.
Yeah.
But others might have been the homophobias there, you know, where it's just like, I think you're going to die, so I'm going to be really cross about this.
And in the first
and
draft,
I hate it about you. Do you know, it's
in the first draft of the book, I didn't actually put those comments by my mom about, you know, be careful, you don't want to get HIV, because I just thought, well, that put her in the, you know, the right light. You know, I was worried it was skewing to the negative on the remarks she had made, you know, because there's other things where I lose a Levi's denim jacket that she'd bought for me and she didn't have much money. And she slaps me because I'm not careful with my stuff and I've lost this jacket. But I suspected someone stole it from the school cloakroom. Like, but, you know, she came
to me. I love what you said there, that you think it might be ghosts.
It could be ghosts as well. Yeah.
It could have been a ghost who stole it.
So. We used to do Ouija board in the school cloakroom. And so we had a kind of belief in the supernatural going through our year at school.
Oh, you see, now if I had have said to my mum that I'd lost a jacket and then I'd revealed that I'd done a Ouija board, it's the Ouija board that would have absolutely sent her off a rocket.
So, but my mum instead put in the comment, you know, put in your coming out to me. It was important. Well, it was important to me as well as to you, you know, so she wanted that.
I love
in
knowing
there.
That.
Yeah. So she's been very supportive of this, as has my partner. So.
I don't think it comes across as being, it doesn't come across as a parent who's not supportive. It comes across as as I say, it's about the consciousness of the time and what would have come to her mind immediately or would probably have already been there.
Yeah.
That worry
that
she had for you. Our Somewhere For Us magazine has featured interviews with many of Scotland's inspiring LGBTQ plus role models and icons, including actors Alan Cumming and Annie Wallace, authors Douglas Stewart and Eli Percy, singers like Horace McDonald and Finn Brody, and sportspeople Bruce Mowat and Robin Love, and many more. Discover more at somewhereforus.org. Can we touch on the theme of silence? It comes up quite a lot. You know, you talk about going back to the barbershop, you talk about the safety in silence.
Yes.
Do you know, and that if you're behind a Game Boy and you're not, you know, you're not joining in, but you're not saying anything about yourself, then there's safety in that. Mm-hmm. But there's also thinking about your poetry and, you know, talking about being silent and afraid. And mm-hmm. you've also, almost in this contradictory way, you've got this very real idea of how being quiet can keep you safe.
Yeah.
But in the quietness, you're also in grave danger.
Yeah.
You know, from yourself, from not being yourself and not having a voice. And I just noting actually on the publicity that we got sent from Canongate, there's a note there from Tom Robinson from BBC Six Music, who says Dean Atta is a man on a mission. and I wonder whether there's part of that mission. It's a question to you, really. What is part of that mission to break the silence?
Absolutely. And I've been doing it through poetry of music, through novels in verse, you know, through picture books now as well as this memoir. So, and Tom Robinson was at my first book launch. He actually chaired the Q&A we had after my reading.
Okay.
And he's played a couple of my poems with music on Six Music and shouted me out a good few times. We've been for tea and cake. So shout out to Tom Robinson.
That's great. And, you know, shout out to Tom Robinson.
His song Glad to Be Gay is so inspiring. And, you know, it's even quoted in Jackie Kay's recent book.
I was going to say, Jackie Kay quoted it a couple of weeks ago on the episode as well.
Yeah. So, you know, he's someone that's kind of paved the way for me, as has many people, you know, such as Jackie Kay, such as Peter Tatchell, such as Ricky Beadle Blair and Topher Campbell. And, you know, there's so many people, Ajamu X, who gets quite a few mentions in the book, who's a photographer that took my portrait and was in a, it was an exhibition of young queer, black queer people at the Guildhall Art Gallery. And my mum didn't know the word queer was okay. Like back then, she was like, hey, can you use
queer? My mum still does. I don't think. You know, because I it's such a loaded word, isn't it?
So that's it. It's like, really, what can you say and what's changed, you know, with the times? You know, every decade there's words change, what we're allowed to say might change, what people feel they're allowed to say because they've been criticized for saying something wrong. You know, so for me, the silence was protective when I was a little boy. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I found poetry, especially spoken word poetry, I knew I could get up on a stage and, you know, articulate myself with these words I'd crafted, you know, in private, but then took them to an open mic night. And shared them with people of all ages as well. Often when I started at 17, I was like the youngest person in the room most of the time. I'd go to libraries and cafes and these open mic nights that they had there across London, and sometimes in the basement of churches, like where they had one in Brixton called, like, I think it was called the Bug Bar. But it was in the crypt of a church in Brixton.
Oh, I love that.
But it was amazing, like, because people would listen to me. And it was, you're being listened to in a way that your school teachers don't have time to, that your parents, if you've got a single mom, often don't have time to, you know. And so these adults were, you know, taking my words seriously, coming up to talk to me about it afterwards. You know, I remember this poem I wrote called Fatherless Nation, you know, about my dad not being around, and, you know, people, you know, in their 50s, 60s, older, saying, oh, I've had that experience. And sometimes it's like, you know, they grew up in a single parent home, or sometimes it's like their dad died and they never got to say the things, you know, because he was a stoic, silent man that never showed his emotions. So they're like, my dad never said he loved me. I know what you feel. And it's like, and so it was really interesting to kind of have grown-ups listen to me when I was a teenager. And, you know, now I'm a grown-up, I write a lot for teenagers too. So they, you know, it's kind of like, it's a two-way conversation. I'm speaking to people my age, but I'm often speaking to people younger than me too, and older still, because, you know, I'm kind of I don't know when middle age starts. I'm only 39, so I'm young, but, like, I feel like I'm in the middle of something. I don't know what I'm in the middle of, but I'm in the middle of something.
I do think so. I think there is something about being in the middle. I feel in the middle. I do. I'm definitely looking forward, you know, and I'm a parent now, so I'm looking forward and I'm thinking about my parents and my grandparents and what they did in a different way.
Yeah.
But I'm also looking back a lot because I'm getting to relive a lot of things through my little ones, and you will be with your nieces as well. It's that
exactly.
You get to see you get to see the world through young eyes. And I think, yeah, middle's pretty good.
I once got asked, oh, do you have any kids? And I said, yes, I've got two nieces.
Oh, I love that.
They are kids that I feel a responsibility to.
Kids in your life. It is about, children in your life. And they can come from all sorts of places.
But coming back to silence, I had this line in one of my poems called Revolution. And it was, the line was, silence is not golden, silence is the truth stolen. And I believed that then when I wrote it in my teens, and I still believe it now at 39. But I often think there is still times when you want to be safe, and sometimes that does mean being quiet or discreet for safety's sake. There's so many countries around the world where it's still illegal to be LGBT, where people can go to prison, can even be murdered, And so I'm really mindful of, not exporting these views. I kind of talk about, I feel like my book and my poetry is very British. Like, I feel like everything I'm talking about is possible here, like in the UK.
Yeah,
I can't necessarily, rooted here for sure, even though I have, family from Cyprus and Jamaica. I can't purport to say, I could have lived my life in Cyprus or Jamaica in the same way as I could live it in the UK. And that's, good to know and good to remember that, what we experience and the things that we prioritize aren't going to be, globally, recognized as the most important things, because some people are just trying to stay alive. Many LGBT people have to do things so discreetly,
There is there's safety in silence, right? Exactly. I think that's when it comes back to that side of it. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when being silent can be useful. I've been on silent meditation retreats, for example, and I talk about that in the book, kind of how meditation and being silent kind of allowed me to recognize how I was feeling in my body and allowed things that were unresolved to kind of come up. And because if you're constantly on the go, which I think if you live in a city, big city like London or Glasgow, or you've always got something to keep you busy, and you often don't sit still, but often as well, silence is important just to listen to other people's opinions, to shut up and listen and learn.
Well, I was just thinking, your voice is like an armor for you. It's like, it's been the way that you've been able to move around the world and feel empowered. That's kind of from what it sounds like, using your art and the form of your voice.
Absolutely.
To make sure that you're not endangered, in a way.
Yeah.
When you sort of stop talking, you start to recognize what is beyond that, what's behind that, and let that come out to the surface. And it's pretty scary, actually.
Which part of it?
The feeling of like really kind of connecting with your body. Oh. When I say this as someone who loves to talk.
Yeah.
Like when you stop talking, what comes up?
Are you asking me or is that rhetorical?
No, I'm literally asking myself that question, staring up into the distance, wondering.
That won't make a good podcast.
Definitely, staring off into the distance does not make a good podcast, no. But that's where my brain went. I was like, what would come up if I stopped talking for a while? Can I just quote you on one of the pieces in the book that it really chimed with me. Mm-hmm. It was when you said, of all the things I wanted in life, six-pack abs weren't even in my top 10.
Absolutely.
It was such a great line, just highlighting that all the expectations, going back to the blue bathtub, it's all the expectations that are put on you, born into this world, as a mixed race boy.
Yeah.
And, not really being able to meet those expectations, or not really, not feeling that you're a fit, if you like.
Yeah.
And it just felt so, I think it's probably so relevant for so many people in our community, that you're kind of born into this cis-het normative framework of living.
Yes.
What success is, and what meeting these kind of standards is all about. Mm. When actually they're just not even in your top 10.
Yeah.
And I think that just says something about the reason why so many people perhaps feel like outsiders. And being outside to that,
absolutely.
You don't always want to feel outside of it, but you do, because I don't I've never wanted perfect eyebrows and I've never needed the perfect pair of heels ever in my life. And it felt really similar to that comment to me in that book.
Though just, I had to find the perfect pair of heels when I did drag. Like I had to find
yes, you might have done. Like
high enough that they looked impressive, made my calves look great, but not too high that I couldn't like balance on them, you know.
And you see, that's just foreign. It's so, so I can't even, it's just so far outside of my own, not just interest, but like instincts.
Yeah.
Like I just don't have an instinct to put heels on.
Yeah.
but I love
my relationship with my body has been, a practical, functional, you know, over and above the aesthetic. Like I think when I was a little kid, it was shaped by my mum wanting me to kind of look well turned out, you know, and my peers wanting to have that Nike tick shaped into the back of my head to kind of like do that thing that my friends were doing.
It says so much that as well. It says so much of the era,
yeah,
and like what was popular, but also the neatness of it,
yeah,
right? And then also this idea of success,
yeah,
you know, and like, yeah.
However, I think, you know, as I got older, it was more, I knew your kind of the way you present yourself says something about you, because when I had dreadlocks, I did get a lot of recognition from Rastafarians and from other black people who thought I was like this conscious guy that was maybe Rasta, but definitely smoked weed. And, you know, because I did poetry as well, it kind of like fed into this kind of like Pan-African idea that I was kind of like getting in touch with my roots, whether that's my Jamaican roots or the African mm-hmm. roots that precede that, you know. So I definitely felt like there was something being presented to the world, but for me it was just like I wanted to try it out, you know. It was just something I wanted to do, and I did it for a few years, and I was a big fan of Bob Marley, and so that was one of the reasons I kind of went down that route. But down to like body and musculature and all of that, I've never been interested in any of that. Like when my, you know, mum would say, you know, when we were on the beach in Cyprus on our summer holidays, you know, if you just did some sit-ups, you'd probably get a six-pack because you're quite skinny. And now I'm not so skinny, but like I feel strong. Like I do lots of activity anyway. You know, me and my partner go bouldering, we cycle, we go for long hikes in the Highlands, you know, and all over the UK, in Wales, in the Lake District, and Cornwall. Like I've been surfing, like I do yoga, like my body is good and serves me well. But it's not like the guys you're going to see on Instagram with six packs, and it's not like the celebrities, you know. It's not even the classic dad bod. Like it's just my body that I love. Like
it's so interesting that we think that there's so much mythology around what's attractive though, isn't it, and what's like desirable.
Exactly.
And it comes from so many different places that's often not ourselves.
Yeah,
like not really asking ourselves, what do I actually find attractive?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
it was you mentioning bouldering made me laugh. As an aside, I've got a straight friend who's on the dating apps, and she said to me the other day, she's like, I do not want to go bouldering, and I need men to understand this about me.
I mean, all men in their 30s.
Without me having to say it.
Currently,
and she's in her 30s, yeah. Right? She's like, I do not want to go bouldering. So, and it's just such a thing of this era that's like a first date. Should we go bouldering?
I know.
No, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. I don't know though. I think there's something charming about it.
I mean, I'd love it.
Yeah, but. yeah. Like one of my early dates with my partner was going into Devil's Dyke, which is in Sussex in the southeast coast of England, and like it was this kind of amazing valley, and I don't think I've done much kind of walks in nature prior, you know, apart from maybe with school a camping trip and doing a bit of orienteering. But like I was just like stunned. I was like, this is like Jurassic Park, like, and I don't know, I think being a city boy, I really had missed out on getting out and about, and so him taking me out into nature just really made me fall for him, like even more than if we'd gone on a couple more, you know, dates for lunch or dinner, and, you know, just sat and talked and faced each other. I think, you know, walking with someone, I kind of, everything felt more expansive, and I felt like I could see a life with him that was going to be full of kind of new experiences and adventures. So, you know, if someone's trying to get you into their hobby, give it a go just to show you're up for it. You don't have to do
it. If you're listening, my friend,
a membership,
you're going to have to boulder.
Yeah. Go bouldering that one time to show you're a good sport.
Oh, that's great. That's so funny.
So, you're new to the Somewhere For Us podcast. There are so many episodes available right now. People who are doing amazing things for LGBTQ plus visibility and representation and for queer community in Scotland. But also people whose stories and memories reach beyond the familiar. It's a place where we can learn about each other, find out where we've been and where we're headed. Together, I hope. Listen to Conversations Now with John Bell, Eli Percy, Will the Hebridean Baker, Ellen Galford, and so many more. So let's connect. Follow me on Instagram, Spotify, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or you can find all episodes at somewhereforus.org/podcast.
Let's talk a bit about queer community then, if that's okay.
Yeah.
We're kind of entering into Pride Month here, and you might be listening to the Somewhere For Us podcast at a completely different time during the year. But Pride has this as a protest and as an event, has a kind of all year round sort of anchor for the queer community a lot of the time. But I do think there's a lot of different feelings about it.
Yeah.
And I wonder for you, Dean, what does Pride mean for you at this point in your life?
I think Pride means solidarity. I think Pride means strength in numbers. I think Pride can be a huge kind of boost for you to carry through to the kind of rest of the year when people aren't being as visibly supportive with their rainbow corporate logos, you know. So I find Pride a great time to catch up with people that, you know, I don't see all year round. You know, I find Pride can be, I mean, I'm planning this year to walk with the Cypriot group in Pride, which I haven't done before, which I'm really excited about, because in the past few years I've joined a group which is the LGBTQ Cypriot diaspora group, and we, you know, bring in both Greek and Turkish Cypriot people, which I think is really beautiful as well. And that is again about the strength in numbers, but also, you know, crossing the border that exists in Cyprus. You know, and so that's really important for us, that like our Cypriotness and our queerness is the thing that's uniting us, and we're not being divided by these kind of national borders and these contested borders, but we are kind of finding what brings us actually closer together. And I think that's been really, really beautiful to be part of. So for me, you know, I've loved UK Black Pride as well. In many years I've gone to that, and I've performed my poetry at UK Black Pride, which happens in London and is kind of focusing on Black and people of colour, but is for everyone. But the people you see on stage will be Black people and people of colour. And, you know, the food, oh my gosh, like going to Pride, a Black Pride, and then having, you know, Nigerian or Jamaican food, it just feels really, you know, I don't know, subversive in some way. I know that's not
true. it's bringing part of those. I mean, like you talked about that, how it can be different around the world for different people.
Yeah.
You know, growing up as queer, isn't it amazing that there's this possibility to be in a Nigerian space, you know, and eat Nigerian food and be with other Nigerians and also be out and queer?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it's very much needed for so many people, and, you know, and everyone else is very much welcome and invited. I think, you know, I've gone to Trans Pride a couple of times in Brighton, and people are genuinely happy I've gone. You know, I'm not trans, but when I'm there, you know, people are happy I'm there showing solidarity and really pleased to see me, you know. And so that's the thing, you know, I feel like when my straight friends want to come to Pride London or Black Pride or Brighton Pride, like I actually am like, yeah, come along, like don't come in bigger numbers than the queer people in the group that are going to be there, but like, you know, I don't want my group to be unbalanced or more straight than queer. But I've also had it where, you know, some years back, you know, a someone I will call at the time a straight friend came with me, and then some years later they actually came out as queer. Do you know what I mean? So you can't assume the straight people that want to come to queer places are actually straight. They're on their own journey, you know. And
yeah, I think, like, and for me, pride is about, it's, I'm there for myself, I'm there for people who can't be there, and I feel like I'm also there for the parts of our community that I'm also an ally for, as opposed to you know, having that identity myself.
But I'm also into,
so I feel like we all have that role, don't we, that dual role of being like, of your, like, self-acceptance and self-exploration and pride in yourself, but there's also some, there's that solidarity element that you just mentioned, and the kind of strength in numbers, that is about allyship as well.
But for me, the queer spaces that are there for me all year round, they really matter, you know. So whether that's
tell me about those.
Well, when I was in Scotland, it was LGBT health and well-being. You know, I accessed them for mental health support, as well as, you know, more creative spaces that they were putting on, and showcases for queer writers, as well as category is books in Glasgow, where, you know, I went to queer yoga, as well as, you know, book readings, and to buy books and to sign my books. So, you know, that was really, really, really special. Since I've been, you know, back in London, you know, Gays the Word bookshop in central London, and the Common Press in East London, they have, you know, events and, you know, do lots for the community all year round. And there's the, yeah, there's so many great spaces that are supporting queer people all year round. So, you know, Pride is wonderful, like, but I think, yeah, outside of the summer, we're still queer and we still need each other. So.
And we still need each other. That's such a good way of putting it. Yeah, and we still need allies, right? Mm-hmm. All the way through the year. Mm-hmm. Horse McDonald recently said on the podcast that we just need, we need people out and about, and we need people to come out. Yes. You can't ask people to come out, but we do need people out and about in society. We need people to kind of be open about themselves and feel able to do that and be visible and role models. And, and that is about just creating a generally more safer space throughout the year, not just across the summer.
Well, myself and Horse were both part of the Coming Back Out ball that the National Theatre of Scotland did. And that was for LGBT people 50 plus or older. I don't think they put 50 plus, they just said older. So it was for people to decide whether they were older or not. But we were the guest entertainment, you know. The ball was for the people that wanted going to the social clubs. They had an amazing, you know, queer Kayleys that took place. And then I wrote a poem kind of inspired by going to visit one of the social clubs and the Kayleys. And it was about kind of, you know, holding hands, like, across generations, across identities, and being together as you do in a Kaylee, you know. And
I love that.
And I just loved that experience of kind of thinking about, you know, I'm only 39, but I'm thinking about what will it look like to be an older queer person in the future, you know. Where will I want to live, like, how, you know, the people that are coming back out in later life, it's such an interesting, you know, experience for them, because, you know, they, if you go into an old people's home, you know, in a care home, you may be, you know, presumed to be straight because you don't have a partner and you've not talked about your sexuality, you know. And so I always wonder, like, what would my life look like when I'm older, and if, you know, if I wasn't with my partner, like, will everyone just assume this old guy's, well, I'm gonna make sure no one knows no one doesn't know that I'm queer.
No one forgets including yourself.
Yeah
I need to wear those t-shirts, don't we? That's what I always think about, like, if there always comes a point in my life where I do begin to forget certain elements of my life. Mm. I feel like I just need a wardrobe to remind me.
Well, so I can just reread my memoir. I can be like, oh, yeah. That's a nice, like,
who is this fabulous young man? that's really, really, yeah, really lovely. Do you know, Kaylee's, how queer are Kaylee's? I mean, it's like the Scots haven't acknowledged that. And I really think that straight cis Scotland needs to acknowledge how queer Kaylee's are, just generally. Do you know, just in terms of, like, people crossing physical boundaries with each other that perhaps in polite society you don't. You know, you're holding hands a lot, you're linking arms. Yeah. The music is so lilty and jilty. Mm. You know, that men in skirts everywhere. Yeah. It's great.
And it just feels so good to be physically connected to people, you know, to have to look people in the eyes to make the crossovers and, you know, to be very trusting of one another in that space, and just how good it feels to move your body, you know, and to, and to be in any kind of community with people, you know.
In gay abandon.
I love that.
I've just made a note. This is not related to what we're talking about, okay. But I just wanted to thank you for the statement that verbal communication is sexy. I'm taking you to a completely different place now in the conversation. But I made a note. I've just written it down because it's such a powerful statement that.
So we're talking about communication is sexy. Consent.
That's about consent. Mm. Yeah. And we don't need to go fully into that. If you're not comfortable too, but I really loved that you not only dealt with some really difficult topics that, you know, deeply personal and traumatic for you in the book, but you also talk about them in a way that feels possible to make change.
Yeah.
I feel like there is this activism in the book in the way that you discuss language and how it can be done.
Yes.
You know, you've actually written it out for people. This is how intimacy and sex can work in fully consensual way.
Yeah. I think, you know, where we share a language, you know, we can use that to the advantage of like really trying to understand one another. And so if that's in the bedroom, you know, just checking in with your partner, you know, asking if they like what's happening, if they want you to carry on, or if they want something different, and, you know, saying what you want and what you like and being really clear, you know, and the practice of that, you know, will make the sex and the intimacy all the more enjoyable for everyone involved. But also, yeah, like body language is a real thing, you know, so, you know, people do say things non-verbally, people are communicating things, whether they're tensing up or, you know, whatever's going on in the body. So you've got to be observant and then ask, put words to that. Don't assume you know what someone's body language means, you know. So I feel like I am aware that there's things that we can convey with our bodies, but I think there are things that we can convey with words. And sometimes, to be absolutely sure, you need both. You need, you know, the body language and the verbal to make.
And that's
it
gonna
clear.
Work. That's gonna work for a lot of neurodivergence as well. Exactly. Like for everybody's different kinds of brains.
Yeah,
that's gonna work. The embodied feeling of you know, comfort or the presumed comfort in the other person.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But just stating it out loud and making, yeah, verbal communication is sexy. Mm-hmm. I really, that struck me. Well, it's been just so lovely having a chat. And I guess my last question for you is what are your hopes for the future as a poet and as an artist, as Dean Atta?
My hopes are, to keep writing things that I feel proud of and to challenge myself to go to spaces where I feel I can add value and, you know, challenge myself creatively. To keep meeting wonderful people through doing this work, whether it's people like yourself, people, other writers, the readers, audiences at events. You know, I'm going to be through July, I'm going to be on tour with Person Unlimited up and down the country. I'll be in Edinburgh and Glasgow, but I'll be all over the UK. And so, yeah, I'm just looking forward to meeting people, and hopefully this book connects with them and they can have great conversations like we're having with the people in their lives, you know?
It really sparks good conversation. It does. Not, I mean, hopefully not just for us, but others too. Mm. And I really valued the time I had to read it and to put aside some time for reading, just generally. I said the same to Jackie Kay. It's so nice. You just, okay, I've got to read something. Therefore, I've got to make time for it. So nice.
So did you make your questions as you were reading the book, or did you wait till you'd finished?
Yeah, I make notes. Mm. What I do is I read through it and things strike me as I'm reading something. They kind of jump out at me, but it's very subjective because it's what's kind of striking me in terms of my own personal experience. So it's hard to be, I don't think you can be objective with that with a conversation in terms of themes. It's kind of what's speaking to me. But I mean, I also know there's so much in there that speaks to the experience of being a mixed race, you know, boy and then growing into adulthood. Yeah. And there's so much about that I read as a white woman actually that made me reflect on so much of my interaction with kind of mixed race friends, but also my preconceptions, and I was learning through it. And I think there's, as a white person, that is something that's really important for us to do is just get behind the language and like a bit like your mum said to you, like, can I give you a reason? Can I give you some reasoning behind that? You know, can I give you a little bit more information so that that thing that you've included in the book about me has a bit more context? And what your book has done with lots of different situations, when especially when thinking about hair and like body and yeah, and we grew up similar sort of era, you know, and what that would have been like at school for my kind of mixed race friends, or of which there were not many, I have to say, Dean. You know, it was such a white environment. So it was just really interesting reading the book as an education, you know, and I think it's, yeah, thanks for that.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for spending
time
with
us. The work continues. yeah, it's been really, really lovely to have you on the Somewhere For Us podcast.
Thank you so much.
It's been an absolute joy. And I really wish you all the best with the book, Person Unlimited, An Ode to My Black Queer Body by Dean Atter. And available through, where would you like people to buy it?
Their local independent bookshop, or if they want the audiobook, I'll be narrating that. So if you like my voice, there's more to come.
I love audiobooks. It's my preferred style at the moment because I can do it while I'm like running around, or yeah, when I'm in the car or whatever. So
there you go.
Yes, please do the audiobook. That'd be very, very nice.
Awesome.
Dean Atter, thank you for spending time with me.
My pleasure. Thank you too, Jules.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. There is a growing number of episodes to explore wherever you're listening, and I'd really appreciate you subscribing, whether that's through Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or giving me a follow on Instagram. I will do my best to keep the posts coming because I really do want people to find out about Somewhere For Us, to keep supporting us. And I want to thank the players of the People's Postcode Lottery for helping to make this episode possible. I'm Jules, and this is Somewhere For Us.